Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the political conventions begin to heighten interest in the upcoming election, there are a number of ongoing battles taking place in courtrooms around the country over who can vote and how they can cast their ballot. For 51 years, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 has greatly enfranchised voting groups who were routinely denied this fundamental right of citizenship. In fact, the 2013 Supreme Court Shelby decision, which invalidated part of that act and the federal government's ability to provide oversight to state voting changes, was thought by some and a majority of the court to be antiquated and unneeded in today's diverse society. But as my guest Ari Berman points out and writes in his history of the VRA, this act has been under near continuous assault legally since its year of passage. He recounts the history and influence of the Voting Rights Act in his book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It's out in hardcover and comes out in softcover by Picador on August 2nd. Ari Berman is a political correspondent and a senior contributing writer for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Ari Berman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
In your book, Give Us the Ballot, you recount the history of the Voting Rights Act and voting rights over the last 50 years, which among all of the civil rights acts has probably had the most resistance. Of all the civil rights acts that took place in the 60s, why is voting rights still the subject of intense legislation and conflict?
Well, I think the Voting Rights Act had so much resistance precisely because it's been so successful. To understand the power of the Voting Rights Act, you have to go back before the law was passed and think about the situation in places like Selma, Alabama. In Selma, Alabama, only 2% of African Americans were registered to vote. In Mississippi, only 6.7% of African Americans were registered to vote. So minority groups were disenfranchised throughout the country, but particularly in the Deep South by things like literacy tests and poll taxes and grandfather clauses and all-white primaries. And the Voting Rights Act got rid of all of those voter suppression tactics and really led to a dramatic increase in minority voting power and a dramatic increase in terms of a different kind of electorate. And so suddenly, hundreds of thousands of people and eventually millions of people were being registered in states like Alabama and Mississippi and Texas. And that led to a real shift in the power dynamics in those states. And so I think the Voting Rights Act, more than any other piece of civil rights legislation, actually shifted power. Other laws, like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, did a lot of amazing things. It said that you could eat where you wanted, and you could sleep where you wanted, and you could go where you wanted. But the Voting Rights Act actually shifted the power dynamics. They changed to the sheriff's war and the state legislators' war and the governor's war. And that prompted a very vicious backlash from those people who wanted to preserve the status quo, both back then and also now.
We would think 40 or 50 years later that shift has been made. Why is there ongoing efforts to undermine voting rights?
Well, I think one is that there were people that just never accepted the Voting Rights Act to begin with. There were people like segregationist governors in the South who never accepted the Voting Rights Act. And over time, those people died out, but there was a new generation of people that came to oppose the Voting Rights Act, either because they were threatened by its shifts in power or because they didn't like the way the law was being applied. And also, I think this relates a lot to the changing demographics of the country, that in 2008, there was record turnout, for example, for President Barack Obama, the first black president. And there were 5 million new voters that cast a ballot in 2008. And of those 5 million new voters, 2 million were African American, 2 million were Hispanic, and 600,000 were Asian American. And they voted 75% for President Obama. And I think that freaked a lot of people out, quite frankly, who didn't get those votes. And they said, well, if the changing demographics of the country are voting overwhelmingly for one political party, then I think the other political party said, maybe we need to change the country's voting laws. Maybe we need to challenge the Voting Rights Act to try to give us a political advantage.
Isn't that the heart of it, is that instead of both parties basically competing for the best ideas, I think a lot of these suits seem to be about changing the rules of the game.
I do, and I think that's unfortunate. I mean, you'd like to believe that both parties would have a commitment to everybody voting, and then we could argue about other things like taxes and spending and foreign policy where there are legitimate disagreements, and there should be legitimate disagreements. But I don't think we should have disagreements over who can and can't participate. And I think, unfortunately, the parties have different theories of the case right now. I think the Democratic Party, by and large, believes they're better off with higher voter turnout. They have members of their coalition, particularly younger people, particularly low-income people, that don't always vote regularly. And if they vote, that party does better. I think the Republican Party believes that their voters, who tend to be more prosperous, who tend to be more regular voters, they feel like they're okay if there's a lower turnout. And then just look at what happened in 2008 and then 2012, when there was higher voter turnouts, Democrats did well. And in 2010 and in 2014, when there was lower voter turnout, Republicans did very well. And so I think that it's unfortunate that there are different theories of the case here, but I think that is what's motivating a lot of disagreement right now about voting rights.
Now, your book tells the history of basically the beginnings of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and all the cases since then that have helped refine it and helped morph that law over the years. Take us back to the beginnings of the act. After the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Dr. Martin Luther King goes to the White House, to Lyndon Johnson, and says, you know, this is really great, but we need to have a voting rights. We can't have equality until we have voting rights in the South. And Johnson's first response is, I don't know that I can deliver that. And so Martin Luther King embarks on a campaign, sort of inevitable given what had already happened, that they were going to campaign for voting rights. Tell us the story of how the Voting Rights Act actually began to become a law.
Martin Luther King was focused on voting rights for a very long time. He knew that the vote was the crown jewel of the civil rights movement that would make all other rights possible. And so the title of my book, Give Us the Ballot, comes from the first major speech that King gave about voting rights back in 1957, when he was only 26 years old at the Lincoln Memorial. And so he had been pushing for voting rights for a long time. And after they had achieved the Civil Rights Act, as you mentioned, King went to visit Johnson at the White House and said, I'm going to Selma to campaign for a Voting Rights Act. And Johnson basically said, I agree with you. I understand we need to do this, but the Civil Rights Act just passed. Give me a few years to get around to a Voting Rights Act. And King basically said, we can't wait. In Selma, Alabama, only 2% of African Americans are registered to vote. People are being killed in places like Mississippi for trying to register to vote. This is an incredibly urgent issue, and we have to do something about it now. And Johnson was basically like, okay, go to Selma and we'll see what happens, and was pretty ambivalent about King going there, even though he had given King mixed signals about whether this was a good idea. And then what happened, the really pivotal event that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act, was the Bloody Sunday March in Selma, Alabama, when civil rights activists, including now Congressman John Lewis, were brutally beaten by Alabama state troopers when they tried to march from Selma to Montgomery, the state capital, to protest the disenfranchisement of black voters. And the entire country watched that event. ABC actually preempted a screening they were showing of Judgment at Nuremberg, a film about Nazi Germany. And some Americans were so confused by the images out of Alabama, they thought they were actually seeing images from Nazi Germany. It was so bad, with tear gas and people being run over on horses and brutally beaten with bullwhips and everything else. And so once that happened, Johnson knew that the Voting Rights Act had to happen immediately, that he couldn't wait. The outcry was so large. And so 8 days after that Bloody Sunday march in Selma, Johnson introduced the Voting Rights Act before a joint session of Congress in a very stirring way. He actually said the words, "We shall overcome," which was really the mantra of the civil rights movement. And then in August of 1965, the Voting Rights Act was passed. And so it was a really dramatic story between King going to Selma in early 1965 and then just 8 months later, the Voting Rights Act becoming law.
But even after that law was passed, immediately there were court cases, weren't there?
Absolutely. Basically, within days of the law passing, states like Alabama and Mississippi were challenging it and basically saying that the federal government didn't have the power to tell states how to set their voting qualifications. And the first challenge to the Voting Rights Act, which was called South Carolina versus Katzenbach, was decided on the one-year anniversary of the Bloody Sunday March. So this happened very, very quickly. And the Supreme Court almost unanimously upheld the Voting Rights Act in 1966. It was an 8-1 decision. And they basically said that the Voting Rights Act was meant to enforce the 15th Amendment of 1870, which said that the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Unfortunately, the 18th Amendment had been ignored for nearly 100 years, and the Voting Rights Act was essentially just meant to give teeth to the 15th Amendment. But I have been really shocked by just how relentless resistance to the Voting Rights Act has been. I mean, you think that once the law is upheld as constitutional, that should settle the debate. But every time you think the debate is settled, a new effort emerges to try to challenge this law. It really is one of the most contested pieces of legislation in American history.
Of course, once the law is upheld and it's begun to be implemented, registrars in the South basically were refusing to do their job, and the Justice Department sends in federal registrars to register, and all of a sudden, there is a flood of African Americans coming to register to vote.
Yeah, and you really have to remember about what this was like. I mean, in places like Selma, Alabama, it was incredibly dangerous to register to vote if you were African American, and no African Americans were registered for decades. And suddenly you had federal officials come to the South, to the most dangerous and most segregated parts of the South, and within days, register more voters than had been registered in nearly 100 years. And so this was a really, really dramatic change. And I think this, to me, was an example of the federal government using its power for the utmost good. I understand that government has been demonized in a lot of different ways. But if you look at the implementation of the Voting Rights Act, you have a case study in the power of the federal government. Only the federal government would have been able to carry this out, would have been able to pass such a sweeping civil rights law, and would have been able to enforce it. And I actually talked to some of those registrars who went to the South in 1965, and these were civil servants. I mean, they were not really expecting to be sent to places like Alabama and Mississippi, but they did their job with a tremendous amount of professionalism, and I think it was really, really revolutionary to have people who had been disenfranchised their whole lives to be able to register to vote. In the county next to Selma, which was called Lowndes County, which was about 80% black, not a single black voter was registered before the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So this made a tremendous amount of difference in people's lives.
My guest today is Ari Berman. He is a senior contributing writer for The Nation, a political correspondent, and he's also the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you mentioned talking to the registrars, and it must have been really interesting for, say, a person based in D.C. all of a sudden to be sent to the South to register, given the high passions of the time. But I imagine one of the great joys of this book was having a chance to talk with Congressman John Lewis, who was at the very beginning of the story on the bridge at Selma and has been watchful over the Voting Rights Act and the efforts to undermine parts of it, and the decisions that have undermined parts of the Voting Rights Act, and just sort of get his viewpoint over 50 years of watching this law in action.
That was really the highlight of my reporting. I think that Congressman John Lewis is one of the greatest living Americans, and he's gone through more than just about anyone else in this country. He's been arrested more than 40 times in his life for nonviolent civil rights activism. He's been brutally beaten within an inch of dying in places like Selma, Alabama. And what's remarkable to me is so many people from the civil rights movement from the 1960s have either passed away or become disillusioned or gone on to other things, and he's stayed with it. He is as committed to the struggle now as he was back then. And you saw that when he, for example, led a sit-in on the House floor to protest lack of action on gun control, or whether he's protested the Supreme Court's gutting of the Voting Rights Act. And I was able to take two trips to Alabama with John Lewis and members of Congress. First in 2013, where we commemorated things like the 50th anniversary of the integration of the University of Alabama and the 50th anniversary of the Birmingham church bombing, and then again in 2015, where we commemorated the 50th anniversary of the Bloody Sunday March. And you really can't understand just how powerful the civil rights movement was until you go back to Alabama with someone like John Lewis, and you both see how things have changed, but also how things haven't changed. We saw remarkable moments, for example, in Montgomery, Alabama. The chief of police actually apologized to John Lewis for the fact that he was beaten in the 1960s and gave him his badge, which no sheriff had ever done, which
wow.
was amazing. But at the same time, we also were there after the Supreme Court had gutted the Voting Rights Act, and there was a lot of tension. It didn't feel like a celebration. It didn't feel like a commemoration. it felt like something that was much more unsettling as well.
Well, one of the things you take us through the book is the continual stream of cases challenging the Voting Rights Act. And even the year after the Supreme Court upholds the law, there's the first effort to say, well, does the Voting Rights Act really mean what it seems to say, that the federal government is going to basically control the state's efforts to control voting in the South? And at the very beginning, one of the first cases, and it was Hugo Black, an otherwise very great liberal scion on the court, who dissents. And he sort of creates one of these arguments that's been at the heart of the conflict over the voting rights. He alleges sort of the federal government going into states' business on elections to, I believe it's the quartering of troops in the colonies by the British regulars. This is one of the arguments that's been at the heart of the Voting Rights Act. Does the federal government have the right to go into the states, which in other parts of the country, the states can entirely control their voting rights? And does it allow the federal government to go into the southern states and have a degree of control over voting rights in the state?
Well, absolutely. And that's really been at the heart of the controversy over the Voting Rights Act. One of the things that the Voting Rights Act did was it said to those states with the longest history of voting discrimination that they had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And that applied to much of the South and some other parts of the country as well, because the people that drafted the Voting Rights Act knew that once literacy tests and poll taxes were struck down in places like Alabama and Mississippi, new efforts would emerge to make it harder to vote, and that the only way to outlaw these things would be to have the states themselves have to approve their voting changes either with the Justice Department or the federal court so that there could be federal review before these laws were put in. And indeed, right after the Voting Rights Act was passed, we saw that states like Mississippi began to change their election laws to make it harder for newly enfranchised black voters to be able to run for office, to be able to be elected, to be able to have real representation. And the struggle moved from whether or not people could register to vote to whether or not they could actually be elected. That was kind of the next generation of the struggle. And that was incredibly controversial. And so the ability for the federal government to review these voting laws gave the Voting Rights Act an incredible amount of power. 3,000 discriminatory voting changes were blocked between 1965 and in 2013. But what the Supreme Court said in 2013 was that those states with the longest history of discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. They said the formula under which these states were covered was outdated and unconstitutional. And that was something that states like Alabama had been trying to get out from for 50 years. And finally, they had a sympathetic Supreme Court that agreed with them, that actually used the progress under the Voting Rights Act, like the election of the first black president, as an excuse to then gut the law.
And that was the Shelby decision.
Shelby County versus Holder, yeah. In 2013.
Yeah. As you went through the history, though, it was really interesting because when Nixon's elected in 1968, you know, we know about the Southern Strategy. One of the tenets of the Southern Strategy was, again, to undermine the Voting Rights Act in the South. And their proposal was, okay, well, let's extend the Section 4 and Section 5 protections of the Voting Rights Acts, which is what was at the heart of the Shelby case, to the whole nation.
And yeah, which was a very creative way to try to kill the law and make it unconstitutional immediately, because basically the Voting Rights Act was targeted. It was targeted at those places where voting discrimination had been historically most prevalent. And so there was no need to require Oregon, for example, to approve its voting changes with the federal government because there was not the same history as in Alabama. And so when Nixon actually came out with this proposal, you had members of Congress saying that this is like trying to build a dam in Idaho because there's a flood in Mississippi. And people like Strom Thurmond knew that if every state suddenly had to approve their voting changes with the federal government, the Voting Rights Act would both become very unpopular and immediately unconstitutional. And so it is, I think, unfortunate that parts of the law only applied to certain places, but I think we also have to remember that certain states had a different history than other states, that the history of New York is very different than the history of Mississippi, and that's something that the Voting Rights Act recognized.
Well, I mentioned that dissent by Hugo Black, which is one sort of reason for opposing Section 4 and Section 5 of the Voting Act, which was eventually Section 4 was struck down, which sort of renders Section 5 inoperable. in the Shelby decision. But beyond that argument by Black, there was another one that, of course, later Justice Scalia, but he was a law professor at the time, was also taking on, which is sort of at the heart of the Shelby decision, that we have to move beyond race. The law has to actually be colorblind and not take these things into account. And that was a powerful legal theory that took probably 30 to 40 years to actually make it into a decision like the Shelby decision.
Yeah, so in the oral arguments of the Voting Rights Act case, Justice Scalia said very provocatively that the Voting Rights Act had led to what he called a perpetuation of racial entitlement, which a lot of people thought was an incredibly outrageous way to describe a law that had brought millions of new people into the political process and really ended once and for all the disenfranchisement of African Americans, which had existed for so many years in the segregated South. But the reason that Justice Scalia said this was because there were a number of people, particularly conservative legal scholars, that were upset with the Voting Rights Act because the Voting Rights Act allowed for the first time you to draw districts that would allow African Americans, Hispanics, other minority groups to be elected. And the reason why they did this is because before the Voting Rights Act, there were just no African Americans, no Hispanics, no Asian Americans elected in much of the country, and none in the South. And they said the only way to do this is to draw districts so that there are majorities or close to majorities of these populations so they can elect the candidates of their choice. And this is how people like John Lewis were able to be elected, by the drawing of what became known as majority-minority districts. But this also sparked a backlash, and people were saying that minority candidates were getting preferential treatment and that this violated what you said was sort of the so-called color blindness that was supposed to exist in American society. Now, I think that this argument against the Voting Rights Act is incredibly hypocritical because nobody had any problems when districts were drawn or are drawn to preserve the ability of white candidates to be elected. That doesn't spark any sort of outcry. But the minute that you draw a district that allows someone else to be elected, particularly someone who's been historically disenfranchised, then it suddenly becomes controversial. But this was a very effective way in which opponents of the Voting Rights Act mobilized opposition to the law. And of course, I mean, everyone wants the U.S. or any place to be colorblind, but unfortunately that's not the society we live in today.
Well, what has been the practical effect of the Shelby decision, which invalidates Section 4, which sort of renders Section 5, and again, it's this effort to for the federal government to sort of oversee how voting changes are made within these southern states. I hope I'm paraphrasing that correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
How has that the invalidation of that section had a practical effect in the South? What have we seen since Shelby?
It's had a big practical effect in the South and also in other parts of the country as well. The first thing that happened was that laws that were previously blocked under the Voting Rights Act, like Texas's voter ID law, were allowed to go into effect. Texas's law was blocked because 600,000 registered voters in Texas did not have a government-issued ID, and Black and Hispanic voters were 2 to 3 times as likely as whites not to have one. Under that law, you could vote with a gun permit, but not a student ID. And so that was a very controversial law that was blocked that was then allowed to go into effect. Then states began to pass more sweeping voting restrictions. A month after the Shelby County decision, North Carolina passed a really sweeping rewrite of its election laws. They not only required strict voter ID, but they cut back early voting. They eliminated same-day voter registration. They eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. They eliminated public financing of judicial elections. All of these great reforms that North Carolina had were suddenly repealed. All of that stuff would have been subject to federal approval before it was implemented. Now it was not. We saw problems during the primaries and this year. So, for example, in Maricopa County, Phoenix, where Phoenix, Arizona is, they eliminated 70% of their polling places between 2012 and 2016, from 200 polling places in 2012 to just 60 in 2016. And that led to five-hour lines and lots of confusion during the primary there. Arizona was another state, not in the South, but another state that was covered under the Voting Rights Act. And so something like that would have had to have been approved with the federal government. But since that was no longer the case, Arizona could then close 70% of its polling places. And the only way to stop it is after the fact, once people have already waited in five-hour lines. And the evidence is that some people left without voting because the lines were so long. Even in New York, where I live, we saw the impact because in Brooklyn, New York, there was a major voter purge that seemed to affect particularly Latino voters more than others. And parts of New York were actually subject to the Voting Rights Act, Manhattan, Brooklyn, and the Bronx, because New York had an English-only literacy test in place until 1968.
Wow.
And so really, I mean, people think about the Voting Rights Act as something that only applied to the South, and that's partially true. But the Voting Rights Act also applied to other places as well, and so we're seeing the impact of the gutting of the Voting Rights Act all across the country. And just a big picture right now is that this is the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. It's the first presidential election since the Voting Rights Act was gutted, and 17 states now have new voting restrictions in place. Some of those laws would have existed without the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, but there are laws in place in places like Virginia, in North Carolina, in Texas that are a direct result of the Voting Rights Act being weakened.
Now, you know, I guess the court upheld Indiana's Voter ID Act. I believe it was Indiana's, either Indiana or Wisconsin's Voter ID Act. And
yeah, it was Indiana.
Indiana. And so I assume that the idea of the photo ID is going to be a part of voting. What really concerns me is what you mentioned in Arizona, and I can remember in the last two presidential elections where voting patterns were either taken into account and they were unexpected. I mean, that's the innocent explanation, where you had incredibly long lines in presidential elections. In Ohio in 2004, I think there was lines 4 or 5 hours, and the thought was that in that particular state where the Secretary of State was a Republican, the thought was in Democratic areas, the lines were longer, fewer voting machines. In Missouri in 2012, they actually kept the polls open till 10 o'clock to allow people to vote because of the long lines. Is there anything that the Voting Rights Act does towards making sure there are adequate polling machines so people don't have to wait in line for 4 to 5 hours to cast their ballot?
That's a very good question. I mean, so basically the kind of things that were reviewed under the Voting Rights Act were voting changes. So a place wants to put a new voting restriction in place, or they want to cut back on something, or they want to redraw districts. All of that stuff was subject to scrutiny under the Voting Rights Act. Now, things that are more technical in terms of the implementation, like how many voting machines a place gets, that is stuff that's more difficult to challenge, and often we don't know ahead of time what's really going to happen. The other problem is that states like Ohio didn't have to approve their voting changes with the federal government, so the federal government could only intervene in places like Ohio after the fact. And I think it's interesting because the Voting Rights Act was gutted in 2013 after we saw big problems in the 2000 election in Florida, in the 2004 election in Ohio, in the 2012 election, once again in states like Florida, when there was incredibly long lines because that state cut back on early voting. And I think that was an argument, if anything, for trying to expand the Voting Rights Act. But instead of expanding it, the Supreme Court narrowed it instead. And so I think we're having the totally wrong conversation. The conversation should have been about how to provide more voting rights protections, given what had happened in past elections, not fewer.
All right. The name of the book is Give Us the Ballot. Ari Berman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rich. I appreciate it.
Ari Berman is a political correspondent and senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It's out in hardcover, but comes out in softcover in a new edition from Picador on August 2nd. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.